for the 20-year nuclear technology vision that we have. Can you tell me about what goals are set in that document?
Indeed, in the name of Allah, the Most Gracious, the Most Merciful. Every organization naturally needs a vision, a defined plan within a specific time frame, outlining goals, policies, and strategies based on studies of actual conditions, aligning the organization's movement with those very directions. By divine grace, we managed to formulate the document for the 20-year vision of nuclear technology with the participation of all relevant parties, leading to the recognition of the industry's potential impact on all dimensions of people's lives and the modern economy. This was well received by all relevant bodies within the Islamic Republic of Iran's administration and establishment, and we were able to have the document unveiled by the president after going through all the stages of approval. In the middle of the last Persian calendar year, when this document was unveiled, the entire organization's movement was aligned with the path laid by the document. We are currently progressing along this path with five primary goals in mind. Firstly, the process of nuclear fuel supply and necessary activities within the industrial chain and testing in the fuel process. Our aim is to complete and reach the capacity necessary to cover the required objectives outlined in the document. This was an effective step, indicating our utilization of diverse resources, allowing our fuel cycle to become a comprehensive, sustainable industry capable of expansion. We are progressing in this direction. The second pillar was clean and sustainable energy. Climate change is a serious global concern, with a net zero carbon emission target set for 2050. Naturally, our country, being highly vulnerable to climate change, has strongly emphasized the goal of producing clean and sustainable energy. We have included the objective of generating 20,000 megawatts of new nuclear power in this vision document, requiring comprehensive scientific and industrial research efforts to achieve this goal. The third pillar observed in this process was the development of the nuclear industry in the medical and health sector. In the medical and health domain, we target expanding the capacity for producing radiopharmaceuticals in order to become a global player and a consistent innovator at the forefront. We aim to benefit from the nuclear industry in producing radioisotopes, radiopharmaceuticals, especially novel radioisotopes, and radiopharmaceuticals, and this too is a focal point of the industry. The fourth focus is the development of irradiation applications and protection against contamination. In a real sense, two extensive steps are dedicated to ensuring food security and community health. We utilize irradiation to sterilize agricultural products. In our country, which annually produces around 130 million tons of agricultural goods, this process helps eliminate toxins and pests and extends their shelf life. This, in turn, contributes to national economic prosperity, supports businesses in this domain, and boosts household economies. Additionally, protection against radiation contamination is crucial. Accordingly, the Safety Protection Center is slated to evolve into a more efficient state institution, capable of appropriately fulfilling its legal duty of radiation protection. The fifth pillar of the vision document concerns human resources. We require effective human resources. Our approach to industrial research and development involves considering the development of human resources and scientific advancement. This pillar includes R&D projects at the forefront of knowledge aimed at practical flourishing, technological attainment, streamlining the innovation cycle from idea to product, and simultaneously ensuring the necessary workforce for the present and future of the organization. These were the five fundamental chapters observed in the vision document.
Right, so let's go over each of these points one by one. So the first one was the procurement of the nuclear fuel for the reactors. So let's talk about the process of getting there. So from the excavation of uranium-235 to the utilization of uranium-235. How much of this process is domesticized, and where are we in reaching that goal we have in the 20-year vision?
Clearly, we're one of the countries significantly affected by unjust double standards. Due to nuclear sanctions, there has been no cooperation provided to us in our nuclear sector. Hence, all our processes in research are directed toward anticipated results, utilizing our research capabilities specifically tailored to yield technological products, especially nuclear fuel. Today, we possess a sustainable capacity for our required fuel, aiming to independently design, construct, and operate power plants, needing critical fuel, and ultimately operating them with Iranian-made fuel.
So let's go over the second point that you mentioned with regards to the goals of the IAEA. According to the recent remarks by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, he said that reaching that 20,000 megawatts of power generated through these nuclear power plants is crucial for the 20-year vision. Where are we along the path of reaching that 20,000 megawatts?
We've designed an operation plan for this 20,000 megawatts. Based on studies conducted in Iran by Westerners over the past 50 years for establishing nuclear power plants, which we updated, we identified regions and established companies for achieving the 20,000 megawatt target by setting up and operating nuclear power generation plants. These companies primarily function along the southern coasts, with one also situated in the northern coastal area, conducting in-depth environmental and geological studies. One of these companies, ahead in its environmental geological data, has progressed to the stage of ordering equipment and initiating operational activities at its site. Therefore, every 20,000 megawatt capacity has been divided into five different regions, each of them in a different phase of operation within the program, and each is in motion.
The third point was the usage of nuclear science and technology in the medical field. So there are, of course, different areas where you can tackle medical sciences using nuclear sciences. For example, let's talk about using plasma therapy and where we are in the world when it comes to our position, when it comes to plasma therapy, and what kind of cancers or different types of illnesses are we targeting with it?
Currently, in the field of radioisotopes and radiopharmaceuticals, we have reached operational capacity with about 50 radiopharmaceuticals used in diagnostic, palliative, and therapeutic areas. Approximately 1 million individuals in the country benefit from these medical services and radiopharmaceuticals annually. Importantly, we're expanding our capacity in this realm, both qualitatively and quantitatively. Qualitatively, we aim for higher precision in diagnostic radioisotopes to aid medical professionals in better diagnosis. And quantitatively, we're striving to enhance their effectiveness, especially for therapeutic radiopharmaceuticals. Currently, we have 13 new radiopharmaceuticals undergoing critical trials, progressing along this path. Parallel to the discussion on radiopharmaceuticals is plasma therapy. We've dedicated efforts to plasma therapy over the past 2 years. Currently, the clinical trial phase involves using plasma for treating non-healing wounds, particularly in diabetic patients. Another clinical phase is plasma therapy for cancer treatment, currently being used in operating rooms. We're expanding plasma therapy utilization for its significant potential in combating cancer, and we're actively pursuing this goal.
Now, before I touch on the fourth point, one of the goals of the IAEA has been to implement the usage of smaller scale reactors. I want to know about the reason behind that and how far along we are in implementing and reaching that goal that we want to.
Look, the objective outlined by the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, and the Global Pursuit, particularly in the recent COP28 summit in Abu Dhabi, where countries pledged to triple their nuclear power capacities, aims at carbon emission reduction. Carbon emission reduction is attainable through increased nuclear power plant capacity. However, not all countries or locations can accommodate large-scale nuclear plants. Hence, research into miniature technology has been underway. This aims to design and build small-scale, widely distributed nuclear power plants in various countries, facilitating the pursuit of the 2050 net-zero carbon emission goal. Because nuclear power plants' efficiency is often over 93% to 95%, unlike other power plants with significantly lower efficiency, the stability and cleanliness of this energy emphasizes accelerating this IAEA-defined goal through scientific and engineering endeavors.
Now, the fourth goal that you mentioned for the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran was the usage of irradiation and the tools that we use to protect the operators from irradiation when they're working in, like, for example, reactors and the radioisotope making. So can you tell us about some of the different tools that we have been able to make? For example, there are the measurement tools, the precision tools that we have made, and also the contamination monitors, and also some of the usages of the irradiation, different irradiation devices that we have made.
There were two important aspects in your question that I want to address. Firstly, in the field of radioisotopes, one rapidly expanding aspect globally is the nuclear measurement system, nuclear instrumentation used in advanced industries. The Atomic Energy Organization of Iran has introduced these systems, and today we have complete mastery of advanced versions of these nuclear instrumentation systems and design, and we produce and provide support for them for various industries in the country. This is one aspect. The second aspect regarding irradiation exposure involves our radiation-generating systems. We have designed cyclotrons and gamma irradiation systems, both pool-type and self-shielded types. We have incorporated these into our agenda to design these systems, procure the required irradiation sources, and through studies conducted for the country's needs, implement these across all production centers, be it industrial or agricultural products, suitable for irradiation. Over a three-year plan, God willing, will establish these to enable products to undergo radiation exposure, creating high added value financially and economically. Most importantly, this contributes to food security and public health. Irradiation not only increases productivity and efficiency, but also enhances safety and health for the people. Another critical point is our capability to provide various educational accelerators and research tools, similar to those in nuclear power plants. You'll find similar simulations, just like the one behind us, in the control rooms of Bushehr nuclear power plant. These simulations serve educational purposes in universities and even in power plants for operational training. These systems, in line with research and human resource development in the fifth pillar that I mentioned, are designed, built, and made available to target centers.
Now, in the process of making all these radioisotopes or these precision tools, the density measurement tools and whatnot, and making of these radiopharmaceuticals, one crucial point, especially when it comes to the reactors and where the radioisotopes are made, is the usage of heavy water and light water. So we consume and produce a lot of both of these two types of waters, and I would assume there's a level of exporting that we do for these light and heavy waters. So what is our place globally when it comes to the exports and the demand that there is for our light and heavy water?
This is a very important issue. Our organization is a key player globally as a producer of heavy water, holding a sustainable share in the international market. Our capacity stands out significantly compared to our competitors due to its quality. What's important for us is not just the heavy water used in reactors, but also its derivatives, approximately 230 types, which find utility across various industries, particularly in pharmaceuticals, especially medications based on deuterium. We're following this path and are thankful that through the efforts of our young scientists and researchers, we have achieved this global standard. We're currently expanding and enhancing the capabilities and the efficiency of these products.
So we're right now at the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, and perhaps the most important parts of this whole facility, this whole area, is the Nuclear Science and Technology Research Center. What is the goal, the main goal, of this Nuclear Science and Technology Research Center?
Relentless movement towards progress serves as the goal of our research sector. This allows us to stay on the path, at the forefront of knowledge, utilize our findings through articles and commercialization of technologies to serve humanity, and expand them. Our distinction from advanced countries when it comes to new sciences and technologies lies in our dedication to serving humanity and sustainability of peace. We don't impose control, but engage with all countries with the aim of making these technologies available to them. Therefore, our research direction aims to remain at the forefront of knowledge and relentlessly pursue new findings.
So a major part of the research side of things happens right here. But how does this research and the results that come out of it get implemented into industries? What does the path look like, and where do knowledge-based companies play a part along this path?
The knowledge-based companies born out of this research stream are technological developers. We undertake the risks associated with these new technologies initially to the extent where risks are minimized, enabling other companies and industries to utilize them. The research flow and the technology development stream in the Atomic Energy Organization is being handled within a knowledge-based network. We have introduced open project policies and innovation, intending to utilize all capacities in the process of transforming knowledge into technology and industry. Our perspective is international, and that's why next year, on the 50th anniversary of the Atomic Energy Organization's establishment, we're organizing the first international nuclear conference in Iran, welcoming various countries and the agency. Our inaugural conference carries the message of peaceful nuclear technology for everyone and nuclear weapons for no one. In this regard, we're pleased that through an international initiative next year, will be the initiators of an active movement to promote nuclear sciences and technologies globally.
Now let's get a more in-depth look at one of these nuclear power plants and see what it is actually capable of. So for instance, the Bushehr nuclear power plant, what is the capacity of its power production, and what can we expect from it in the future?
The power plant number one in Bushehr is a facility with a nominal capacity of 1,025 megawatts. This power plant, in the year of 2023, has completed its 10th year of operation. To date, it has injected over 62 billion kilowatt hours of electricity into our national grid, preventing the emission of over 90 million cubic meters of greenhouse gases and saving approximately 90 million barrels of oil. This demonstrates Iran's commitment to clean energy. We're addressing a lag in the construction of power plants by expediting the implementation of units 2 and 3 in the Bushehr power plant, currently under construction. Our endeavor in executing the 20,000 megawatt plan is to showcase ourselves as prominent players in the global field of atomic power plant design and construction. It's a response to the political turmoil and psychological security measures that have been fabricated against Iran's nuclear program, which are entirely false and baseless. We operate transparently and under the supervision of the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, extending our nuclear activities for peace and security.
So the Bushehr facility is a nuclear power plant. Over here, in this facility, we have a research reactor. What are the other research reactors or power plants that we can expect in the future to be made?
We currently have two research reactors that are being designed and constructed. One is a 20-megawatt research reactor, and the other is a 10-megawatt research reactor. Additionally, we have a zero-power research reactor intended for educational and research purposes in the design and construction phase. These three projects constitute our research backbone. supporting our national education and the production of various radioisotopes required in the medical and industrial sectors.
So the next subject would be nuclear fusion technology. It's, to my understanding, the next step for us. So where are we along the path of reaching the technology to be able to use nuclear fusion and the power that we get from that?
This is a very important point. Nuclear fusion is the future, particularly when it comes to achieving clean, sustainable energy. And it is being pursued collectively and individually by nations. In our country, within the Atomic Energy Organization, one of our key and fundamental projects is the nuclear fusion project. Utilizing all scientific and research elements that can assist the organization and participate in the projects, we have initiated these plans with the goal of creating a tokamak with a designated scale. Hopefully, we can present our research findings.
So why even is it the future step? Why is nuclear fusion technology more difficult to achieve? And how do you compare the power or the usage that we get out of nuclear fusion compared to the nuclear fission reactors that we already have?
It's evident that this path is both challenging and costly, involving time-consuming and expansive research efforts. All nations involving in this matter are working towards maintaining sustainable energy. No one casts an economic view on this matter. Everyone is working on it with a scientific and research-oriented approach. What matters is the existence of this activity, regardless of the scale or duration of the energy derived from nuclear fusion. The importance lies in mastering the processes, elements, and components to transform it into a system, be it projects carried out worldwide or aligned with the focus observed in France. We are continuing our efforts independently, aligning with those pursuits.
So let's stay on the topic of these international governing bodies, namely the IAEA. So the International Atomic Energy Agency has said in a recent report that Iran has increased its production of highly enriched uranium, to which you responded that there has been no change in our capacity for production. Do you think that the IAEA may be playing into the hands of the Zionist entity and their propaganda machine?
This is quite clear. Even in the instance where the Director General speaks and warns the world, saying, "Don't forget about Iran while your attention is on Gaza," it fuels Iranophobia, contrary to international norms and against the rights of a nation. We haven't engaged in any undisclosed activities for him to caution us like this or to remind us that we need JCPOA 2.0. These actions are adherence to requests that are made of them. We have always requested the Director General to uphold the agency's credibility as an international independent body, unaffected by political agenda. And we stated in a March 2023 statement addressing the agency that the framework of our activities are based on the IAEA safeguards and the NPT. Considering the remaining items, we will interact and define a modality for the remaining issues and in-between matters between the two parties. These three clauses exist. There is currently no discrepancy or non-compliance between us, even regarding inspectors. The issue with the inspectors is an inherent right of any country and nation. According to Article 9, the agency must introduce inspectors to us. We evaluate the inspectors and express our opinion. This routinely happens. If we cancel a designee inspector or several inspectors, it's within the realm of inspections, and those inspectors hadn't even come to Iran in the first place. Then they portray it as if their inspectors were expelled. We didn't expel any inspectors. There haven't been any inspectors in Iran whom we expelled. There is a list, a roster, currently 125 inspectors, if I'm not mistaken, who are designees, meaning Iran has agreed for them to visit. However, not all of them necessarily come to Iran. So the excessive focus on Iran, the timely and untimely reports about Iran, is entirely contrary to norms. It's a double standard, and we strongly oppose this double standard. We have expressed our grievances to the agency, and always expect the Director General to maintain that international credibility of the agency and not join the pressure group, the group consisting of three European countries that exert pressure on Iran, never align with them, and allow our relations to proceed naturally within the framework of the agreements and the MPT.
Mr. Islami, thank you very much for joining the program and for your time. Well, you heard about how the International Atomic Energy Agency has been adopting double standards with its approach to Iran and where it may be originating from. It's unfortunate, but that's the way it is. But that's not going to stop Iran's advancements in different fields of nuclear science and technology. That's going to be it for this edition of Face to Face.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
In the United States, the Wisconsin Republican Mike Gallagher has said a forced TikTok sale could absolutely happen before next November. We take a look at the US media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. The Wisconsin Republican Mike Gallagher has said it will be best if TikTok were out of China's hands before the next November's election. Representative Mike Gallagher, a Wisconsin Republican, said on Sunday, 17th of March, that the forced sale of TikTok absolutely could happen before November's election, as legislation that would demand the sale or ban the app altogether makes its way through Congress. The closer we get to an election, the risk just gets greater and greater, Gallagher said on Face the Nation program on Sunday, 17th of March. He talked of the threat posed by the widely popular video sharing app TikTok. TikTok has for years been under fire by US officials amid warnings that China's government could gain access to its data and use it to manipulate or spy on Americans. But a renewed push against the app gained momentum last week as the House approved legislation that would compel the company to either sell the app within 6 months or be banned from US app stores. Wisconsin Republican Mike Gallagher, who spearheaded the bill, noted that it will be in the financial interest of ByteDance's investors to effectuate before sale, saying that the user experience of the app would likely improve with a decreased concern of propaganda should the company move away from China-based ownership, causing TikTok to increase in value. On the risk that TikTok could pose to Americans, Representative Raja Krishnamurthy, an Illinois Democrat, said, "This is a different type of threat that we've seen before." He noted that TikTok differs from other social media platforms because it's effectively controlled by a foreign adversarial nation. And lawmakers in the House widely seem to agree, as the legislation saw significant bipartisan support just last week. But whether the Senate agrees remains to be seen. Representative Raja Krishnamurthy noted that he'd had very positive conversations with senators who, he says, are very interested in this bill and who are very surprised by the size of the margin of the overwhelming bipartisan support in the House. But how quickly Senate leadership decides to act on the bill is an open question. Kara Swisher, a business and technology journalist who appeared separately on Sunday and Face the Nation program, noted that there's a lot of people who would buy TikTok, like the owners of Microsoft, Meta, Apple, or a consortium of companies. But she said the question will revolve around what exactly they're buying, noting that the algorithm behind the app will likely remain in China's control. What do you buy precisely because the algorithm's not coming with this company? The Chinese government would never let that happen, Swisher said. You're buying 170 million, say, US users and a great brand, but the algorithm isn't there. The website Politico has also covered this story and tells us more. The Wisconsin Republican Mike Gallagher thinks a forced TikTok sale absolutely could and should happen before the 2024 election. The closer we get to an election, the risk just gets greater and greater, the Wisconsin Republican said on Sunday. Gallagher's comments come as the fate of TikTok hangs in the Senate. On Wednesday, the House passed a bill 352-65 that would force the Chinese parent company of TikTok, ByteDance, to divest TikTok within 165 days or risk the app being banned in the United States. The Senate is now expected to take up the bill, but its passage there is expected to be much more shaky. President Joe Biden has said he will sign the bill if it gets to his desk. Mike Gallagher cited a threat assessment by the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, which states that China may attempt to influence the 2024 elections in the United States, and that some accounts on TikTok, which were operated by the Chinese government, are reportedly targeted specific candidates on both sides of the aisle during the 2022 midterm election cycle. Every single intelligence community official that testified before the Intelligence Committee last week suggested that under its current ownership structure, TikTok is a threat to America's national security, according to Mike Gallagher. Essentially, the Chinese company ByteDance is the 100% owner of TikTok. ByteDance basically has an editor-in-chief who is embedded at the highest echelons of the company and controls all of its products. Mike Gallagher was asked about another factor that could complicate the bill's passage in the US Senate, a last-minute change of opinion from presumptive Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump, who said last Monday that while he believes TikTok poses a national security threat, he opposes banning the app in the United States because he believes it would benefit Facebook, his current Silicon Valley bete noire. Mike Gallagher didn't criticize Donald Trump directly, but took aim at the lobbying campaign, which has heavily featured former Trump advisor Kellyanne Conway. They're really weaponizing the swamp against legislative action, Gallagher said. Over $500,000 spent last quarter alone on 7 different lobbying firms. And it's disgusting.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Salam Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum Assalam. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And we are going to talk about some of the jurisprudential laws related to the month of Ramadan and fasting. Sheikh Javid, let me start this episode with this question. Somebody asked, I wear medical glasses, and at the present, my eyes are too weak. The doctors told me if I do not strengthen my physique, my eyesight will get weaker and weaker. So if I'm unable to perform the Ramadan fast, what would be my duty?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, if fasting is harmful for his eyes, then it is not obligatory to fast. The truth of the matter is that it is obligatory for an ailing person who has genuine fear that fasting might hurt him in one way or the other. It could hurt his eyes or maybe other organs, important organs of his body. Then it is not even permissible for him to fast, because fasting is not supposed to harm someone. It's not supposed to hurt you. So if, for example, if your illness continues until next Ramadan, then it is not even necessary for you to give the qadha. There's no qadha either. Mm-hmm. So it is necessary that you give only one mud of foodstuff. One mud is equal to 750 grams of foodstuff, which you should give to the needy if you can afford it. Mm-hmm. That is the point.
Okay, thank you very much for this answer. There is another question that somebody asked. My mother is seriously sick, and my father is also physically weak. Nevertheless, both of them fast. Sometimes it's quite evident that fasting aggravates their illness. So far, I've not been able to persuade them to refrain from fasting, at least at times when their illness is serious. Would you please guide us concerning the rule that applies to their fasting? Some people have the same problem. I had the same problem with my parents. Sometimes they're too old and too weak, and still
persist
on, actually fasting, although they know that it's somehow harmful for their health.
Yeah, I'm very much sure that there are some elderly people, grandparents, for example, who should not fast.
Yes,
because they are too weak, emaciated, and actually old enough, which actually makes it unnecessary for them to fast.
Mm.
So the criterion actually in determining the inability of inability to fast, or whether fasting aggravates someone's health or not, is the opinion of the fasting person himself.
Right.
Maybe just as we talked some in the previous episode. Maybe a doctor tells you something, but you have your own opinion, your own judgment of your ability. So if you think you can fast, there's no problem. You should fast. But okay, sometimes you think it's not it's not harming your health. It's not injurious to your health. It does not aggravate your health. then if, okay, there is someone who gives you a better advice, you should listen to him. Because, for example, if someone is 85 years old, 90, and he is very old, he must have his drink and water and food on time, then he should not fast, because fasting might harm.
Deteriorate the situation, yes. Yeah. Thank you very much. Let's take a short break, and then we'll be back to continue our program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. Stay tuned.
Ya Allah, thank you for another chance standing at my door. Ya Allah, you've given me hope, delivered this gift right to my home. Marhab, marhab, ya Ramadan, ahi qulubana bil Qur'an.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad Hosnan, and Sheikh Javed, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to fasting and the blessed month of Ramadan with Sheikh Javed. Somebody asked, Sheikh Javed, last year I had a surgery on my kidneys, and the surgeon ordered me not to fast for the rest of my life. However, I eat and drink normally and don't feel any signs of illness. What is my duty?
Well, if you personally do not fear, and I'm talking to that person because he says, I had surgery on my kidneys last year, so I'm talking to him. I should say that if you personally do not fear any harm in fasting, and there is no reasonable ground to be afraid that fasting might negatively affect on your health, on maybe on your kidney, and it will not aggravate your health condition, then it is obligatory to fast. Because you yourself better know, you know better than everyone else that fasting does not harm you. Even if the doctor has told you not to fast until the end of your life, but okay, you know fasting is not, you can make it, you can do it.
It's so true, Sheikh Javed, that doctors actually give their prescription based on each and every case.
Yeah.
When they see their patients, and generally they give orders like
orders.
And prescription, for example, what to follow and what not to follow, or what to eat and what not to eat, or what pills to take and what not to take.
Yeah.
But the thing is, the symptoms do not immediately show up.
Sure, you're right.
Right? And these people might see nothing, they have no fear because they don't see any signs or symptoms for their diseases, but later they might run into some problems.
If they do not fast because of the fact that, okay, the doctors advise them, they are not to blame, okay?
Mm.
Because they are justified in not fasting. They listen to someone who is an expert in healthcare.
Yes.
Okay, so if they do not fast and later they find, okay, it was good for him not to fast, so that's good, okay? But if they happen to fast, contrary to what the doctors told him, the fasting is considered to be valid in this situation.
And also some doctors, Sheikh, especially I'm talking about the Western Hemisphere, like in the West, because mostly the doctors and physicians are not aware of the Islamic laws. They are not Muslims, right? They are in a non-Muslim populated area. And when you, as a Muslim patient, refer to those doctors and hospitals, and they may, tell you, for example, to eat every, I don't know, few hours, or drink every few hours, right?
Yes.
And, obviously they don't know anything about, for example, Ramadan and the rules of Ramadan, which is fasting, basically.
Yes.
And should these Muslim patients obey those non-Muslim doctors or physicians?
Well, as you know, doctors give their advice regardless of your religious beliefs,
yes,
and or your background in his maybe, and your religious teachings. So, in fact, if a physician's statement makes a patient confident that fasting is harmful for him,
mm-hmm.
or he has genuine fear of harm as a result of fasting because of certain, let's say, reasonable grounds that he sees, so then it's actually not obligatory for mm-hmm. him to fast.
Okay.
Rather, in some cases, when it is generally feared that fasting might have a negative effect on his health, it is even not permissible to fast.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's come back after a short break and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah. Guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We're still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to the month of God, Ramadan, and fasting. Sheikh Javid, somebody asked, I have kidney stones, and the only way to prevent them from calcifying is to continuously consume water and fluids. As doctors have prohibited me from fasting, what's my duty regarding fasting during the blessed month of Ramadan?
Well, doctors do give their expert opinions regarding things they witness through their own experience and observations. Of course, when you have developed a kidney stone, it is necessary to act according to your doctor's advice. And in some cases, it's necessary, of course, as you rightly mentioned, it's necessary to drink water every now and then in order to make the stone come out. So, of course, if the treatment or the illness requires that you drink water and or maybe other beverages as prescribed by the doctor, it is obligatory to act according to your doctor's advice and not to follow what you would like to do. Maybe some believers do like to fast, and fasting provides them with a very pleasant experience. So it's better, it's sometimes obligatory that they actually follow the doctor's advice and not to hurt themselves.
I see. Even some people are not basically sick or ill, and they are not considered as patients, and they don't refer to the doctors, but yet they fear some kind of medical condition for them. Like, for example, if they don't drink, they're going to have trouble. What about those individuals? Since they don't refer to the doctors and there are no doctors to tell them, for example, whether to do this or not, then what is their duty?
Well, it's not always necessary to turn to a doctor and get his advice on one's health. One's personal judgment about his own health is important. So, if one knows and has the genuine fear that it is fasting might be harmful to his health and may cause him some damage in some way or another, then actually it's not obligatory on him to observe fast.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Sheikh Javed. And thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, as the host of this program. And from the rest of the crew, we say wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Oh Allah, please unite us and guide us to paradise. Oh, and guide us to paradise. Ramadan is here. Allah's mercy is near. Time to give, time to share, time to show.
Congratulations to all at the arrival of a spring and revival of nature. Congratulations to all at the arrival of a spring and revival of nature. Congratulations to all at the arrival of a spring and revival of nature.
The limelight.
Hunger is particularly acute in the bombed out northern half of Gaza, including Gaza City, where hundreds of thousands of Palestinians remain after the Zionist regime ordered the forced displacement of people from the area a month earlier. Palestinians in the north of Gaza are now starving, as the Zionist regime has prevented the UN from delivering aid there for more than a month. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, the Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza said that 112 Palestinians were killed and another 760 injured after the Zionist regime forces opened fire toward Palestinians who had gathered to receive food aid in Gaza City recently. The incident, dubbed the Flour Bag Massacre, is one of the deadliest in the past bloody 4.5 months in Gaza, with the death toll climbing past 30,000 recently. The actual number of fatalities since October 7th is likely significantly higher, with thousands of people missing under the rubble of destroyed buildings and others succumbing to disease, starvation and thirst. An engineered famine has taken hold in Gaza, with people resorting to eating wild plants with little nutritional value and animal feed to survive. Abu Bakr Abed, speaking from Gaza, told the Electronic Intifada live stream, "It's been all suffering. It's been all horror." Hundreds of babies are born in Gaza each day and their parents can't find formula or afford diapers for their newborns, as Abed reported in a recent story for the Electronic Intifada. Abed, who is immunocompromised, said that he has eaten meat probably only once since October 7th, and the lack of access to the nutrition he needs has caused him to be repeatedly sick. The lack of clean water results in regular stomach pain. feed a meal typically consisting of just a piece of bread and tomato, Abed said that he's relatively fortunate. One in four people in Gaza currently faces catastrophic levels of food insecurity, according to the United Nations. Hunger is particularly acute in the bombed-out northern half of Gaza, including Gaza City, where hundreds of thousands of Palestinians remain after the Zionist regime ordered the forced displacement of people from the areas months earlier. Palestinians in the north of Gaza are now starving as Israel has prevented the UN from delivering aid there for more than a month. Seven children have died from starvation and dehydration at Kamal Adwan Hospital in the north, according to the Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza. Life essentials and humanitarian aid are being used as weapons of war in the Zionist regime's military campaign in Gaza, with Israel announcing on October 9th that it had cut off the supply of fuel, electricity, water and food to the territory. Only very limited amounts of aid have been allowed into Gaza since then, for less than what is needed to meet the needs of the now mostly displaced population. In late January, the International Court of Justice ruled that there is a plausible risk of genocide in Gaza, echoing Palestinian human rights groups and several independent UN human rights experts. The court ordered the Zionist regime to halt all genocidal acts, including by taking immediate and effective measures to enable the provision of urgently needed basic services and humanitarian assistance. The food aid massacre in Gaza City is a flagrant violation of international humanitarian law and fully goes against the International Court of Justice provisional measures ordering the Zionist regime to halt genocidal actions, Petra D. Sutter, a deputy prime minister in Belgium, said recently. The Geneva-based Euromed Human Rights Monitor said that at around 4:30 a.m. recently, Israeli regime tanks shelled a crowd of thousands of hungry civilians who had been waiting hours for aid trucks to arrive. The rights group has documented previous cases in which Israeli regime troops opened fire toward and killed people awaiting aid. Recently, according to Euromed Monitor, after the aid trucks arrived, Palestinian civilians were targeted by Israeli regime shelling and shooting. Numerous people fell from the trucks while attempting to take a bag of flour, the group said, adding, many others were targeted while carrying a carton of canned goods or a bag of flour to feed their starving family members. Ismail Al-Ghul, a reporter with Al Jazeera, said that after opening fire on them, Israeli regime tanks ran over dead and injured people and that ambulances were unable to reach the scene because the roads are totally destroyed. Many of the injured were brought to the Ashifa Hospital, which is only partly functional after being raided by Israeli regime forces last November. With a shortage of medical staff, citizens were left to deal with the injured and attempt to administer first aid themselves, according to Euromed Monitor. Jadallah Al-Shafai, a department head of Ashifa Hospital, said that the majority of the victims suffered gunshots and shrapnel in the head and upper parts of their bodies. Ashrafi added that they were hit by direct artillery shelling, drone missiles, and gun firing. Videos documenting the incident show people running as shots ring out with an Israeli tank positioned nearby. At least one victim appears to have been shot in his upper torso. D. Daniel Hagari, the chief Israeli regime military spokesperson, said during a press conference recently that the trucks were part of a convoy carrying aid from Egypt that was screened at the Karam Abu Salem crossing and then entered Gaza for distribution by private contractors. He claimed that tanks were present to secure the humanitarian corridor for the aid convoy and that troops cautiously tried to disperse people he described as a mob who rushed the truck with a few warning shots. Hagari attempted